the last class, we discussed a historical overview of our involvement in the Vietnam War. In this class, we want to do an analysis of what went wrong in the Vietnam War. In analyzing the Vietnam War, one thing all the writers, particularly the military writers, seem to agree on, we fought the war the wrong way, and we made a number of mistakes. And I think at this point, all you can do is to try and analyze the mistakes honestly and make sure we don't make the same mistakes the next time, if there is a next time. And unfortunately, there's usually a next time. The first point is that the United States did not study, policymakers did not study, analyze, and understand the North Vietnamese strategy. And in many ways, this is in the strategic tradition of U.S. Ulysses Simpson Grant. When Grant took over the Union Army in 1864, some of the Union commanders were saying, well, Lee's going to do this, Lee's going to do that. And Grant's reply was, don't tell me what Lee's going to do. What are we going to do? Don't worry about the enemy. We'll impose our will on the enemy. And that's pretty much the approach we took in the Vietnam War. North Vietnamese strategy. First of all, their strategy was a prolonged application of total force. Prolonged. This was contrary to the American tradition of a strategy of annihilation, a decisive battle strategy. They're fighting a total war. We are fighting a limited war. They're trying to put in a new social order, not just land reform or ending corruption or some limited goal. With the French, they understood that the French had to be decisively defeated because French draftees were not going to serve in Vietnam, and so they had to defeat the French army, which they succeeded in doing. With the Americans, they understood that what they had to do was not necessarily win the big battles, but inflict casualties and cause enough pain. For the South Vietnamese, they wanted to force the South Vietnamese government to collapse and assassinate officials and just undermine the people's confidence in the whole system, and that's what they worked on. Giap instituted his three stages of revolutionary warfare. Now, this is like Mao's three stages of revolutionary warfare, but oddly enough, the North Vietnamese don't like to give the Chinese credit for much in the war. They still to this day like to say that they did it all on their own and that they could teach the Chinese a thing or two. And the three stages of the Revolutionary War were first to establish bases, then go to a guerrilla war against lines of communication, and then when the time was right, go to stage three, which would be conventional all-out assaults on the armed forces and the government. And they would shift back and forth from this strategy. Periodically, they'd make that all-out offensive. It didn't work. They'd slip back to an insurgency. So when you say, was it an insurgency or a conventional war? It was a little bit of both. It was an insurgency and a conventional war, sometimes at the same time in different provinces. So it's hard to put it in one category. They also believed they would fight while negotiating. Talk, talk, fight, fight, is the way they put it. The prospect of peace reduces willpower. The American center of gravity, they determined, was public opinion. And finally, the enemy controlled the tempo of the war, going from one phase to another as they were ready. Now, the North Vietnamese made a lot of mistakes in their strategy. They miscalculated. In 1965, they thought it was time for a mini phase three and launched into some conventional battles with the first American units. And they suffered drastic casualties and pulled back and didn't do that again. In 1968, they went over to conventional warfare again in the Tet Offensive. But again, they had horrendous casualties, even though a great political outcome from it. And then in 1972, they went into a conventional attack using tanks. But their logistics and maintenance was very poor. A lot of their tanks broke down and the whole offensive ground to a halt. So they did make mistakes and miscalculations. I think the United States underestimated the willpower of the North Vietnamese. They had a tradition of being a warlike people at times. They took pride in their campaigns against the Mongols and the Chinese and fighting against the Japanese. They had a ferocious motivation, a combination of nationalism, communism, and revolutionary fervor. Their leaders were first-generation revolutionaries, a certain dynamic, fanatical zeal there. And they were very inspirational, people like Ho Chi Minh and Giap, as opposed to the South Vietnamese leaders. Their leaders had a lot of experience. They'd been fighting since 1945 or earlier. And this fanaticism was transferred to the people. And when you came up against North Vietnamese regulars, they did not surrender easily. And even main force Viet Cong units in the Tet Offensive, at one point they finally got about 80 of them to surrender. That was a big news item. That didn't happen very often. And they found them with tattoos, born in the North to die in the South. They internalized this. Their concept of political mobilization helped to motivate their people. It was a people's war, and not in the sense they're fighting it so much for the people, but the people are instruments of war, like Clausewitz's idea. They're engines of war. And in achieving political mobilization, the three aspects that they concentrated on was, first of all, mobilizing the people for war, then organizing them into political or military activities. And from this mobilization and the process of organization would come motivation. And that generally worked for the North Vietnamese population. And finally, they paid a lot of attention to what outsiders thought about the war. They assigned about 35,000 cadre members to working on the world's public opinion and trying to do whatever they could to shape the world's view of the war. The very fundamental problem we made was a failure to isolate the battlefield and sever the supply lines. You've got a map there that shows the supply system for the enemy troops. About 90%, 85-90% of their supplies came from Russia to the port of Haiphong and then to Hanoi. About another 10% or so came down two railway lines from China into Vietnam. And from there, they would put it on trucks and bring it down the Ho Chi Minh Trail into South Vietnam. There were other supply channels going directly to the Delta and through Cambodia, but the main one was coming from the Russians. And when we talk about the Ho Chi Minh Trail, this is not a little trail in the jungle where you're following it single file. It developed into 13,000 miles of all-weather roads, highways A, B, C, and D. When you bombed out Highway B, they rerouted the trucks on Highway C. And they've got all sorts of nice pictures of bumper-to-bumper traffic coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They had sanctuaries in Cambodia and Laos. When things got hot in South Vietnam, they could pull across the border and they're safe. And we didn't violate those sanctuaries until much too late. Remember, the key date in the Vietnam War is 1968. After 1968, the war has been decided. It's just a question of how long it will take us to withdraw. So any measures we take after 1968 are not going to influence who wins the war. They know who's going to win the war after the beginning of 1968. With this supply line, they were able to keep about 300,000 troops supplied. In fact, the big debate between Westmoreland and CBS and that issue was whether there were 300,000 enemy troops or 600,000 enemy troops. Let's say there were just 300,000. That's a lot of people to keep supplied. You need bumper-to-bumper traffic to keep them supplied. Those lines were severed. They'd done some intel estimates, and they estimated they could keep about 25,000 to 30,000 main force units supplied just by infiltrating supplies, but not this host that they kept supplied for most of the war. By 1969, they built an oil pipeline down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. so it was easier to fuel their vehicles. So this war is out of control, and it's never under control, and it was never even close to being under control. Now, of course, one of the issues is, well, what about Chinese intervention? And in fact, the Chinese had intervened in the Korean War. Up 300,000 Chinese crossed the Yalu River and attacked MacArthur. So they had intervened in the Korean War. There were about 50,000 Chinese working along the railroads and manning some of the anti-aircraft positions in Vietnam. Now, this is a judgment call, but I think it was an unwarranted fear for a number of reasons. First of all, the Chinese were very aware of what happened to them in the Korean War. American air power in the Korean War devastated their lines of supply and caused massive casualties. They ended up losing about 800,000 troops in the Korean War. So they were aware of this. Also, if you look at the geography, supplying troops into South Vietnam goes through some very nasty terrain in South China. There's only two railroad lines. So it'd be very difficult to supply a lot of troops in North Vietnam. China at this time, from 1965 through 68 and 69, is going through the Cultural Revolution. China is in chaos. And finally, the main Chinese activity was worrying about the Soviets and their border disputes. Apparently, the Soviets were considered even nuking the Chinese, according to some reports, in 1969. All of war is a risk, and you can never tell what is going to happen. As Clausewitz says, it's unpredictable. But you have to take a calculated risk. And I think there was a reasonable, more than reasonable chance that the Chinese really were not going to intervene and were in no position to intervene if they wanted to. Another problem, we didn't send enough troops. If you're talking about 300,000 to 600,000 enemy troops, well, with the 10-to-1 rule, you need, what, 3 million to 6 million? Depending on the technology which helps us, depending on the terrain, and that terrain, triple canopy jungle, is ideal for guerrillas. So we need a lot of troops over there. We ended up sending a peak strength of 542,000. Well, that's kind of misleading. How many fighters do you have out of there? How many trigger pullers do you have out of 542,000 troops? We ended up with about 80% of our troops in logistical support. And as you calculate out how many troops were actually out there looking for the enemy, 100,000 is tops, and it might go down to maybe 60,000 that are actually out there looking for the enemy, conducting these sweeps. That's not many troops. The North Vietnamese, on the other hand, they have 300,000 enemy troops in South Vietnam. They had a very small logistical base because they couldn't build logistical bases. They didn't have helicopters and all of that. So about 80% of their troops, as we calculated, about 80% of their troops are fighters, and only about 15 to 20% are support troops. So when you get out there and match up the numbers, could very well be that our maneuver troops were outnumbered by the guerrillas. So you're just not going to get it under control with that ratio. The South Vietnamese, they had about 300,000 in action before 1968, but before 1968, the South Vietnamese army was riddled with corruption and inefficiency and was not very effective at all. They got better after 1968, but not much better. Unit cohesion and combat experience. Now see, the first troops we sent to Vietnam, 65, 66, 67, it's a long war, you know, it depends on when you served there, who you know that served there, what year he served. Someone who served in Vietnam from 65 through 68 went over with crack units. Well-trained, well-led, well-disciplined, some of the finest troops we ever sent into combat. Starting around 1968, the quality and the experience starts going downhill. One person commented that we were not in Vietnam for 10 years. We were in Vietnam 1 year, 10 times, because of our rotation policy. Commanders in the field rotated every 6 months. 6 months in the field, 6 months in the rear area, and then you're gone. It's over. There was an individual rotation policy. And quickly that developed into the point where everybody's fighting their own individual war. You know how many days you have left in country, not your unit, you. And when you hit below 100 days, you become a two-digit midget, and you can see the end of your tour coming along, and you sure don't want to get killed near the end of your tour. Casualties, very serious casualties. In Vietnam, like every other war that the Americans get involved in and most armies get involved in, the infantry takes the bulk of the casualties, a good 90%. This study on the 9th Infantry Division from 1968 to 69. That unit suffered 14,000 casualties in that 1 year. And again, there's about 3,500 infantry slots. Most of them are coming from those infantry slots. So you're just rotating people through there with the 6 month for officers in the field and back in the rear area with individual rotations of people who weren't killed and wounded. You could see you didn't know from week to week who was going to be in your unit. That's not the way you build unit cohesion. There was a factor of exhaustion. You just couldn't put troops out there in the field and leave them there year after year. So that was certainly was a factor. By 1969, we start having severe discipline problems. Done some studies on drug abuse in Vietnam and all of that. And they pinpoint July 1969 as the start of discipline problems, AWOL, desertion, drug abuse. And from my own experience, that's just about right. I can clearly remember in July 69, on the way out of Vietnam, going through some rear area bases of some of the troops there, and the contrast between 68 and 69 was startling. 68, these were crack troops, well motivated and all of that. By July 69, I ran into some undisciplined rabble in the rear areas, and it wasn't just because they were rear area troops. There was something seriously wrong with the way the Army was functioning. Before 1968, as I said, there was great unit cohesion and good morale. That went downhill. By 1970, they did a report on the World of Charlie Company. And that's instructive. You see the troops in there, they're given the order to move out. Well, they debate about it. Should we move out or not? You know, we're not really going to do this. This could be dangerous. And the officers trying to convince them they should move out and follow orders. Things have gone downhill. The bottom line is, as far as unit cohesion and combat is concerned, we win every tactical engagement, just about, of battalion size or greater, but it doesn't really have that much effect. Gradual escalation. The U.S. is fighting a limited war with limited objectives and limited means. The North Vietnamese are fighting a total war, and they match our buildup as we gradually escalate. They are fighting a total war and matching our buildup and keeping up with us. And, of course, there are great political costs to gradual escalation. And it really wasn't gradual escalation in the sense of a progressive use of force, stronger and stronger every year. It was escalation and then de-escalation. On again, off again. So they always had time to recover. A question is, well, what about a declaration of war? Was it possible to get a declaration of war? Senator Fulbright commented that he thought in February 1965, Congress was in a mood for a declaration of war. And then maybe again right after the Tet Offensive. When the Tet Offensive hit, the reaction of the military was that this was good. We'd won this battle. The reaction of the people, they did a poll in March 1968. And they said, are you a hawk or a dove? 61% of the people interviewed described themselves as hawks. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the Vietnam War? 74% said they're optimistic. It'll be all right. So the military and the people are in it. It's political leadership that's really discouraged. Rules of engagement. We had a lot of rules of engagement. And of course, you're out there to win hearts and minds, seriously. And you need rules of engagement. You just can't go shooting up the place. But these rules of engagement got out of hand. 1975, Senator Barry Goldwater read them all into the Congressional Record, and they're kind of instructive. On our strategic restrictions, we refuse to blockade the port of Haiphong. We refuse to mine the port of Haiphong. We weren't going to bomb dams or dikes, so they put anti-aircraft guns on the dams and dikes, knowing they wouldn't be hit. We weren't allowed to bomb railroad bridges. Don't bomb the sanctuaries. No pursuit. Tactical restrictions. Artillery support, for instance, in South Vietnam went through a very complicated system to call fire. When you took fire from a village, you had to check all the way through the American chain of command, down through the Vietnamese chain of command, through the provinces, to the districts to get clearance to fire. That would go up through the Vietnamese chain of command and back down through the American chain of command. I remember one instance where the unit took fire at 8 o'clock in the morning. At noon, my counterpart and I left, and they still hadn't gotten permission to fire back. You know, the artillery is theoretically supposed to be on call in a minute or two. When you're going into villages, you had to drop leaflets or use loudspeakers. Any friendly troops in there or friendly people in there, please leave because we're about to assault. So you put all these restrictions together, and it means that your effort is going to be seriously hampered. In 1972, Nixon lifted a lot of these restrictions and goes to bombing and mining. It's way too late. Way too late. On these rules of engagement, one judgment made was that no other armed force in modern history was ever called upon to fight under such severe restrictions. Restrictions that actually aided the enemy. U.S. superiority in firepower, both air and artillery, was deliberately not exploited in North or South Vietnam. The air war against North Vietnam was hampered by orders that targets, munitions, and strike tactics will be selected to minimize risk of collateral damage to civilian population, which that's fine, but then you're really never going to get at the target. Technology, we had a great technological advantage, but technology was overrated in this war. We had tanks and APCs, armored personnel carriers, but you couldn't use them in most of the terrain. So the tanks end up doing escort duty for convoys or very restricted in their mobility. Helicopters. Helicopters gave in many ways, a false sense of mobility. You know, they look good, and sure, they could drop troops in areas. But first of all, they had a great logistical requirement. You have to build up a huge logistical area to run helicopter operations. And that restricts your strategic movement of these helicopters. Landing zones were very limited. Usually, you had to blast a landing zone in the jungle, and it was pretty obvious where these landing zones were going to be. So you weren't going to really surprise that many people. And then once you jumped off the helicopter carrying your 70 or 80 pounds of equipment into a rice paddy in that heat, in that humidity, well, your mobility is 1 mile per hour, if that. And remember, most of our casualties are booby traps, so you're going along looking for the trip wires, not just scooting through the jungle. So how many units are you really going to overrun that way? One study that was done showed that 88% of the contacts were initiated by the enemy troops, not the friendly troops. Bombing. Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder ended up being a failure. Admiral Sharp, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific, said it was an example of flagrant misuse of air power. First of all, the objectives were confused. little bit of the problem we had in World War II. What was the objective? Was it the will of the North Vietnamese? Was it tactical support in South Vietnam? Was it to be used to interdict the lines of communication, destroy the industrial targets in North Vietnam, a bargaining chip in negotiation, on again, off again? We never really solved that problem. And it was conducted tentatively, on again and off again. And the rules of engagement, without being able to bomb the certain railroad bridges and dikes and the city of Haiphong and the city of Hanoi in the crucial stage of the war, meant you were really restricted. You almost had to catch a convoy from Haiphong on the way to Hanoi that wasn't on a railroad bridge or near a dam or a dike. Then you could bomb it. There was no real unity of command with this use of air power. Civilians selected the targets. They had this Tuesday lunch group that would meet with Johnson and McNamara and sometimes Dean Rusk in there. They would approve or select targets to be used. And the terrain was difficult, and so you couldn't see what you were bombing most of the time. To summarize, we dropped three times as many bombs on Vietnam as we did in all of World War II. But it didn't do that much good. We might as well have dropped half of them into the South China Sea. The North Vietnamese were not that far behind technologically. When you get out there in the jungle with an M16 against an AK-47, machine guns against machine guns, surface-to-air missiles, that evens up the score pretty quickly. We can't get the tanks and the APCs out there. Now, this is supposed to be a guerrilla war. By 1969, Hanoi is one of the best protected anti-aircraft targets in the world. The South Vietnamese. And we got involved in that conflict because we were hoping to keep communist system from taking over another chunk of the world, and our primary interest is containment, and at the same time we're trying to encourage Diem to reform or his successors to reform. Turned out to be very difficult in the midst of war and because of the allies we had. South Vietnamese government was riddled with corruption. They cheated the peasants of their rice allowance and cases like that. Premier Key wrote a book on it, Why We Lost the War in Vietnam, and he documents pretty convincingly the corruption of the South Vietnamese officials. Now, he says he wasn't corrupt, but the others were, so it's pretty good. It may be true. The leaders, Ho Chi Minh and Diem, there was really no comparison. At one point, Key made the remark that he really admired Adolf Hitler. That didn't go over well in the press. What kind of allies are we working with anyway? The Americans didn't understand the Vietnamese. There's a great culture shock when you went over there. You didn't understand the language. And the Americans didn't cooperate that well with the Vietnamese. And the American attitude, by and large, was that we could do it ourselves, at least before 1968. I remember the officer I was supposed to be an advisor to, he'd already been fighting for 10 years. When I got there as a brand new officer, what could I tell him? He just kind of patted me on the head and humored me for a while. The South Vietnamese didn't understand the Americans worked both ways. The South Vietnamese were reluctant to take advice very often. The South Vietnamese army was really a feudal structure. They recruited from the local areas. And it was the little, almost the personal army of the local lord out there. They had very few units that were a national army. They had the Marine Division, the Airborne Division, some Ranger units, and some good South Vietnamese units like the 1st Infantry Division. But by and large, it was a feudal structure that was tied to the local areas. In logistics, they had a lot of problems with maintenance of helicopters, and just running a whole logistical system. It was a non-technical society. Subversion. They were riddled with informers, and invariably a lot of these plans were getting out, and it was hard to conduct operations with security. pacification. They were supposed to take the lead in pacification, but they were alienating a lot of the South Vietnamese people. After 1969, they did get better, and a lot of their units fought well in the 1972 offensive. But by 1973, they're running out of spare parts and breaking down. And by 1975, they have a feeling of abandonment. And with the 75 offensive, they suddenly collapsed. Willpower, morale is gone. Well, as you might guess, by this time we have a problem with strategic leadership on this war. And I think it started at the top with President Johnson. President Johnson, to his core, he's a politician, and he's looking forward to elections. And he took a consensus-oriented political approach to strategy. Didn't really want to make the hard decision to get in or to get out. He always went for the middle course. And he had a reputation that loyalty was his main concern there. He could be rude and crude and profane in dealing with people. He was not the kind of person, the point is, he was not the kind of person you wanted to bring bad news to. So there was really no honest debate on how the war was going. In 1966, a Marine general gave an interview and came up with a comment that he thought it was going to take 5 years and 750,000 troops to get this war under control. He was told to retract that and not get involved in that debate anymore. Johnson didn't expect a long war. No one really does. And in July 1965, we quietly went to war. They didn't alert the country, didn't mobilize the reserve or the National Guard, and there was no great support. And I think Johnson was psychologically defeated by the Tet Offensive that seemed to break his willpower. In summary, I think with Johnson, Johnson the politician could not become Johnson the decisive military strategist, which in many ways is what you need there. Secretary of Defense McNamara, he was a hawk under Kennedy. He didn't seem to get along very well with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There's one account where he was dealing with them. They were talking about the bombing pause, and the president said, you know, if he puts in this bombing pause, the chiefs will go through the roof. And McNamara responds, "I can take on the chiefs. The chiefs will be totally opposed. We decide what we want and impose it on them." And that seemed to be the approach. So they're making policy and they'll let the chiefs know. And you contrast that with World War II, for instance. General Harold K. Johnson, the Army Chief of Staff from 1964 to 68, he made this comment. "There was, I felt, an unfair, unreasonable, illogical effort on the part of many of the assistance to Mr. McNamara, to get the Army staff to submit recommendations that had been prepared in the office of the Secretary of Defense. I think this is wrong." Okay. McNamara was discouraged by late 67 with the effects of the bombing. Well, with all the restrictions, it wasn't very effective. It didn't seem to be doing much. You've got one chart there that shows the infiltration rate for the North Vietnamese. And their monthly infiltration rate goes from 1,500 in 1965 to about 20,000 a month in early 68. It's out of control. McNamara also pushed the statistical war, the body count, some way to measure success. They interviewed the generals after the war, and about 70% of the generals said they had no faith whatever in the body counts. It was just too murky. You weren't going to send troops back out there again to count bodies. What they want to hear. Call it in. Now, it's hard to gauge that. We don't know how much was really accurate and how much was exaggerated. The Hamlet evaluation system, another device they came up with. What you were supposed to do was rate Hamlets A, B, C, and D, depending on the degree of security. Well, this was murky. I remember one advisor was going to give a Hamlet a B, meaning it was secure, you felt secure in there at night. And he said, yeah, you know, with an airborne battalion around me, I feel pretty secure at night. It wasn't very accurate. The Joint Chiefs in Westmoreland. See, in World War II, we have Marshall Eisenhower, MacArthur. The Joint Chiefs in this war, I don't think, were very forceful in their positions. One comment on General Westmoreland was, he thought he could win the war. That seemed to be his greatest failing. He really thought he could do it with the resources available. Our leaders were World War II veterans. Their experience was conventional war, not insurgency. And the Army didn't really teach that much going into the war. Unity of command. Serious problems with unity of command. Johnson and McNamara provided no real objectives and control. Again, there was no victory plan. There weren't goals and objectives and means of implementing that. No centralized plan. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were not listened to very well. In Vietnam, for instance, General Westmoreland he's blamed a lot for the war, but he had a very narrow span of control. He controlled the ground troops in South Vietnam. That's all he controlled. The Air Force was under the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific and operating out of Thailand. The pacification program was under the ambassador and his assistant, Robert Comer, a very strong individual called the blowtorch. And he would do what he thought was right. The State Department was involved in the negotiations. The South Vietnamese were a world unto themselves. In a strange way, maybe what you needed over there was a MacArthur to tie it all together. The press. If you want to start a discussion in any military circles, mention the press in Vietnam. But actually, I think before 1968, the press was generally supportive of the war. I remember reports by Walter Cronkite and Huntley Brinkley about what a great job we were doing over there with nation building and all of that. With the Tet Offensive, the press turned dramatically against the war. Why? Well, I think it was obvious that the strategy was bankrupt. We did have about 700 reporters in Vietnam, reporters everywhere you went, out in the fields, in the rear areas, in the officers' clubs, wandering around Saigon, reporters everywhere. And they'd let them in because they thought the war was going well. And they didn't really make an effort to get them out. But the press did discourage Johnson. Like Art Buchwald wrote a column, Dateline Little Bighorn, after the Tet Offensive there, that General Custer says, everything's under control, don't worry about a thing. After 1969, with the My Lai incident, that one great atrocity in the war, the press piled on after that, and the press reports got more and more unfavorable. And this is a debatable point, but I think the fault was not really with the press. The basic fault was bankrupt strategy and poor strategic leadership. The anti-war movement. Before 1968, it was not very effective, except perhaps in Johnson's mind. I think most mainstream Americans did not identify with that. But it did discourage Johnson. The main effect of the anti-war movement was after 1969. It encouraged the North Vietnamese. They could see, for the demonstrations at Kent State and whatever, they could see that if they just held on, they would get everything they wanted from the conference table. What should we have done? Well, there are two general schools on that. One you might call it counterinsurgency school and the conventional school. If you take the counterinsurgency approach that the war was basically an insurgency, well, then what you have to emphasize is land reform, nation building, ending corruption, protecting the population. You'd put out small units and out-guerrilla the guerrilla if it's an insurgency. But I think the flaw with that is that this is not an insurgency. This is not 5,000 guerrillas in Malaya. These are main force units that are just going to overrun your districts or provinces, and you never get a chance to establish security. The other school that it was really a conventional war in a way. Shall we call it a conventional insurgency? Because it's unique. It's unique. It's not just an insurgency. The North Vietnamese are the enemy, not just the Viet Cong in the South. And you really had to hit North Vietnam if you want to win this with mass destruction. And invade or partially invade North Vietnam or Laos. There's a lot of debate about, well, should we have cut across the jungles of Laos and established a line there? Well, how many troops would it take? Was it doable? Well, at least something like that would stop the bumper-to-bumper traffic coming down the trail. They could infiltrate supplies. They could always get through, but not in trucks, not to that level. Or destroy the rail lines and the bridges and the industry, you know, in early 67 or 68. Blockade the port of Haiphong to isolate the battlefield. Mobilize the Reserve and National Guard. By 1970, about 90% of the troops in the field are draftees. And a lot of them don't want to be there by 1969 or 1970. And, of course, the critique of this strategy is, well, you still have a guerrilla war. It wouldn't end the war, would it? No, it wouldn't. You'd probably still have 20 or 30,000 guerrillas operating, but it would bring it down to a manageable level. This war's out of control. Some of the issues on Vietnam are, one concerns intelligence in Vietnam in the Westmoreland CBS case. There was a problem with unity of effort in intelligence in Vietnam. A lot of different agencies, the CIA, the State Department's Intelligence Research Bureau, National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, a lot of different agencies there. You had the Military Advisory Command in MACV in South Vietnam, Army Intelligence, Navy Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, a lot of different agencies. And I think politics did influence somewhat the kind of conclusions they came to. They didn't want to say certain things to Johnson and his assistants. A lot of the intelligence assessments were affected by unrealistic qualifications. If the South Vietnamese government will reform, then it'll be all right. If the bombing works, we could win this in a couple of years. If the South Vietnamese army becomes capable, well, they'll be able to manage. Some of the other issues, atrocities. The dictionary defines atrocities as the cruel killing of a large number of people. In that sense, there was one atrocity and about 300 other documented war crimes in Vietnam, individual cases, you know, like in that movie, Casualties of War. By and large, it was hammered into the officers going to Vietnam that you're there to win hearts and minds. Don't do anything to antagonize the South Vietnamese. It'll just make more recruits for the North Vietnamese. The problem with the My Lai massacre was that it was led personally by the officer in charge, Lieutenant Calley. And his testimony at his trial shows that he participated and did the shooting. So that got out of hand. As for the rest, you can't make any excuses on that, and you wouldn't want to. In World War II, there were about 250 war crimes of different sorts. But see, in Vietnam, when they went to make movies about the war, this is a lot of what they focused on over there. So a lot of it is creation of the movie here. As to how the war was fought, in World War II, they focused on heroes. In Vietnam, focused on other things, and I don't think there were atrocities being committed that we don't know about. There can always be that, but there were 700 reporters in Vietnam, as I said. They were everywhere. If this was systematic, if this was part of the system, they'd know about it, and it'd be on the 6 o'clock news. So I think we know just about what happened, and that's what happened. Yeah, there were some, but. Not the way some of the movies portray it. Vietnam veterans. And again, this is the problem with the movies. The World War II movies focused on the heroes. Here you've got Taxi Driver and Coming Home and The Deer Hunter and Casualties of War, and that's what you see in the public mind. They did a survey of Vietnam veterans in 1980. Well, the Veterans Administration did. 71% of them said they were glad they went. And 66% said they would serve again. And to their mind, it was a noble cause and they were trying to do the right thing. And I think it worked out that it was really faulty strategy and poor strategic leadership. The effects of Vietnam. The short-term effects in the 1970s, there was a lot of breastfeeding and disappointment. Particularly in academic circles, it was looked at as a transition of American power, hurt American reputation. We're supposed to be the good guys, and we get involved in this messy war. Foreign policy, it affected the foreign policy of the 70s, this Vietnam syndrome. The military, a lot of problems in the military, not only in Vietnam, but in Europe. I think the low point occurred when the Army finally adopted the slogan, "The Army wants to join you," in the early 1970s. And with the Democratic Party, a definite swing left of center there. The long-term effects. I think the election of Ronald Reagan was a reaction to the Vietnam syndrome. And the U.S. has come back strong, that $1 trillion buildup and pushing the Soviets to the breaking point. Which brings us to the Russians in Afghanistan. The Russians launched into their Vietnam-type war in Afghanistan. And in many ways, committed a lot of the errors we committed. They did not isolate the battlefield. There were always supplies coming in through Pakistan. They didn't send enough troops, about 115,000 Russian troops, to try to keep control of 150,000 Mujahideen. They never got that under control. They didn't make an effort to win hearts and minds, and if they did, it didn't work very well. The regime that was aligned with the Russians was compromised and didn't gather the support of the people. So they ran into pretty much the same buzzsaw that we ran into, with a lot of the same fallout. Lessons of the Vietnam War. I think the first lesson is that when you're entering upon a conflict, you have to understand the enemy and his strategy and his motivation. Secondly, gradual escalation has great political costs. And if that's what you want to do, that's difficult for a democracy. If you elect to use force, use overwhelming force. The psychological shock is as important as the physical shock. Win quickly and get out. Have we learned these lessons? I think so. I think if you look at the statements, the presidents and the Secretary of Defense and the generals over there in Iraq right now, I think the Vietnam War is prominent in their minds. President Bush, speaking of the Iraqi situation, stated on the 30th of November, "If it comes to war, this will not be another Vietnam. This will not be a protracted, drawn-out war. We will not send troops into combat with their hands tied behind their backs. And I pledge to you there will not be any murky ending." So it seems like we did learn those lessons. That concludes this lesson and this short course on military history. Thank you.